Looking for a smarter choice for dental implants? Meet the Contact Dental Implant System from Biotech Dental. Trusted by clinicians across Europe and now available in the US. With a single prosthetic connection, streamlined surgical kits, and seamless digital workflows, Contact makes every step easier. It's clinically proven, intuitively designed, and surprisingly affordable. See for yourself why more dentists are switching to Biotech Dental's Contact system. Visit biotechdentalusa.com today to learn more. That's biotechdentalusa.com.
Stop doing the things that you know are wrong that you could stop doing. Right? So it's a fairly limited attempt. First of all, we're not going to say that you know what the good is or what the truth is in any ultimate sense. But we will presume that there are things that you're doing that for one reason or another you know are not in your best interests. There's something about them that you just know you should stop. They're kind of self-evident to you. Other things you're going to be doubtful about. You're not going to know which way is up and which way is down. But there are things that you're doing that you know you shouldn't do. Now, some of those you won't stop doing for whatever reason. You don't have the discipline, or maybe there's a secondary payoff, or you don't believe it's necessary, or it's too much of a sacrifice, or you're angry or resentful or afraid. Who knows? So forget about those for now. But there's another subset that you could stop doing. It might be a little thing. Well, that's fine. Stop doing it and see what happens. And what'll happen is your vision will clear a little bit. And then something else will pop up in your field of apprehension that you will also know you should stop doing and that you could stop doing because you strengthened yourself a bit by stopping doing the particular stupid thing that you were doing before. That just puts you together a little bit more. And you could do that repeatedly for an indefinite period of time. And you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to ever be able to formulate a clear and final picture of what constitutes the truth and the good. But it does mean that you'll be able to continually move away from what's untruth and what's bad. And, you know, that's not a bad start. Make a damn schedule and stick to it. Okay, so what's the rule with the schedule? It's not a bloody prison. That's the first thing that people do wrong. They say, well, I don't like to follow a schedule. It's like, well, what kind of schedule are you setting up? Well, I have to do this, then I have to do this, then I have to do this, you know, and then I just go play video games because who wants to do all these things that I have to do? It's like, wrong. Set the damn schedule up so that you have the day you want. That's the trick. It's like, okay, I've got tomorrow. If I was going to set it up so it was the best possible day I could have, practically speaking, what would it look like? Well, then you schedule that. And obviously, there's a bit of responsibility that's going to go along with that. Because if you have any sense, one of the things that you're going to insist upon is that at the end of the day, you're not in worse shape than you were than at the beginning of the day, right? Because that's a stupid day. If you have a bunch of those in a row, you just dig, you know, you dig yourself a hole and then you bury yourself in it. It's like, sorry, that's just not a good strategy. It's a bad strategy. So maybe 20% of your day has to be responsibility and obligation, or maybe it's more than that, depending on how far behind you are. But even that, you can ask yourself, okay, well, I've got these responsibilities. I have to schedule the damn things in. What's the right ratio of responsibility to reward? And you can ask yourself that, just like you'd negotiate with someone who is working for you. It's like, okay, you got to work tomorrow. Okay, so I want you to work tomorrow. And you might say, okay, well, what are you going to do for me that makes it likely that I'll work for you? Well, you could ask yourself that, you know. So maybe you do an hour of responsibility and then you play a video game for 15 minutes. I don't know, whatever turns your crank, man. But, you know, you have to negotiate with yourself and not tyrannize yourself. Like you're negotiating with someone that you care for, that you would like to be productive and have a good life. And that's how you make the schedule. It's like, and then you look at the day and you think, well, if I had that day, that'd be good. Great. You know, and you're useless and horrible, so you'll probably only hit it with about 70% accuracy, but that beats the hell out of zero, right? And if you hit it even with 50% accuracy, another rule is, well, aim for 51% the next week, or 50.5% for God's sake, or because you're going to hit that position where things start to loop back positively and spiral you upward. Of course you struggle to remember it in your day-to-day life because life is difficult and it's harder to do things than not to do them, and it's harder to do them well than to do them badly. You know, and it's easy to sit around and be hopeless. I don't mean it's emotionally easy because it's not, but it's procedurally easy to be useless and to fall back into your old habits and to not discipline yourself and
It's a matter of continual practice, slow continual practice. And I think a good example of that is something like weightlifting. You know, if you start a weightlifting program, which I would recommend, by the way, because it's tremendously advantageous physically and cognitively, you're not going to really see results for a number of weeks, and then the results are rather slow. But you can get pretty decent results over a six-month period and absolutely stellar results over a couple of years. And so you have to make sure your time frame is right and not to be too hard on yourself. And I did mention the future authoring program earlier. And one of the things I would recommend, too, is if you're having a hard time implementing your decisions, say your ethical decisions, that you spend a bit more time thinking them through and writing them down. And the Future Authoring Program is really helpful for that. That's why we designed it. And so get your goals straight and continue to practice every day. And if you're not succeeding, then make your goals slightly smaller. You want to make your goals large enough so that they challenge you, but small enough so that you have a reasonable probability of succeeding at them on a day-to-day basis. And then you have to also understand that if you fail on a given day, like let's say you're trying to quit smoking and you quit for 2 weeks, and then you have a cigarette and you think, oh my God, now I've screwed it up.
Looking for a smarter choice for dental implants? Meet the Contact Dental Implant System from Biotech Dental. Trusted by clinicians across Europe and now available in the US. With a single prosthetic connection, streamlined surgical kits, and seamless digital workflows, Contact makes every step easier. It's clinically proven, intuitively designed, and surprisingly affordable. See for yourself why more dentists are switching to Biotech Dental's Contact system. Visit biotechdentalusa.com today to learn more. That's biotechdentalusa.com.
I'm not quitting anymore. You smoke a whole pack of cigarettes. It's like, well, there's a couple of mistakes there. And one is, well, just because you had a cigarette doesn't mean you failed. It just means that you had a cigarette. You can start stopping again the next day. And the fact that you had one cigarette in the last 2 weeks is a hell of a lot better than the 2 weeks that you had before that. And so you've got to be realistically humble. You've got to be ambitious enough in your goals so that you're pursuing something that you regard as truly meaningful and worthwhile. You know, and maybe you can judge that to some degree if you think about someone you love attempting the same thing and think about how you would feel if they managed it. And if you would feel good, then that's probably a good evaluation strategy to use on yourself. So you want your goals to be of sufficient nobility so that you can live with yourself properly if you're pursuing them, but you want them to be small enough so that you have a reasonable probability of implementing them.
If you're harmless, you're not virtuous. You're just harmless. You're like a rabbit. A rabbit isn't virtuous. It's just can't do anything except get eaten. It's not virtuous. If you're a monster and you don't act monstrously, then you're virtuous. But you also have to be a monster. Well, you see this all the time. Harry Potter's like that too. It's like he's flawed, he's hurt, he's got evil in him. He can talk to snakes, man. He breaks rules all the time. All the time. He's not obedient at all. But, you know, he has a good reason for breaking the rules. And if he couldn't break the rules, him and his little clique of rule-breaking, you know, troublemakers, if they didn't break the rules, they wouldn't attain the highest goal. So it's very peculiar, but it's a very, very common mythological notion. You know, the hero has to be a monster, but a controlled monster. Batman is like that, you know. I mean, it's everywhere. It's the story you always hear.
Compare yourself to who you were yesterday and not to who someone else is today. Yeah, because if you're comparing yourself to someone else, I mean, first of all, you don't know very much about the life of the person you're comparing yourself to. You don't know it, across all of its dimensions. And second, people are very different. And so comparing yourself to someone else, it's kind of useful, I guess, when you're young. But as you get older and more singular and more particular, it becomes increasingly less useful. Better to compare yourself to a previous version of yourself and work for improvement in that way. When I was 25 or so, I probably weighed about 138 pounds. I smoked like a pack of cigarettes a day. I drank a tremendous amount of alcohol. I was from Northern Alberta, this rough little town up in Northern Alberta called Fairview. And, you know, there were long winters there and my friends were heavy drinkers and most of them dropped out of school by the time they were 15 or 16, went off to work on the oil rigs. And, you know, it was a rough town and we drank a lot. And I started when I was 14 and, you know, I had a lot of bad habits, let's say, and things that were, and I wasn't in great shape physically, and I was also still intellectually obsessed by, as I am now, and so that would have been in 85. But I decided around then, about 85, 84, something like that, maybe a little earlier, that I was really going to try to get my act together. And so I started doing that. I quit smoking. Well, that took a long time because I eventually had to quit drinking too in order to quit smoking. And I started working out, started playing sports, which I'd never done. You know, I don't regret that. I had a fine time when I was a kid, but I needed really to get disciplined. And I had to do it because I was working on these hard problems that, you know, that I've been discussing with all of you, and I've been working on them really, you know, obsessively since I was probably about 18, maybe even earlier than that. And got to the point around 25 when I was in graduate school trying to get my PhD, so doing all my research. Like, I published 15 papers by the time I graduated with my PhD, which was, by a fairly large measure, the most papers that any graduate student at that time had ever published at McGill. I think that's right. It might have been twice as many, or maybe twice as many, maybe even three times as many. And at the same time, I wrote Maps of Meaning, which was a terrible, terrible, terribly difficult thing to do, because I was writing about 3 hours a day doing that. And I couldn't do all that and continue with my misbehavior, you know, my massive hedonistic consumption of alcohol and all of that. I just couldn't keep it up and also work seriously on the issues that were at hand. So, you know, I had to stop. That's a sacrifice. I had to stop messing about and straighten myself out. If people are not listening to you, stop talking to them. And that is the best piece of advice that I can give you. And what happens is that if you stop talking to people who aren't listening to you and start watching them instead, they will tell you what they're up to. But so if you have things to say, say them, but you find people that will listen, talk to them. The ones who aren't listening, pull back. Because you're devaluing what you have to say by offering it to an audience that does nothing but reject it. And that's a good guideline to life in general.
Don't underestimate the power of truth. There's nothing more powerful. Now, in order to speak what you might regard as the truth, you have to let go of the outcome. You have to think, all right, I'm going to say what I think. Stupid as I am, biased as I am, ignorant as I am, I'm going to state what I think as clearly as I can. And I'm going to live with the consequences, no matter what they are. Now, the reason you think that's an element of faith. The idea is that nothing brings a better world into being than the stated truth. Now, you might have to pay a price for that, but that's fine. You're going to pay a price for every bloody thing you do and everything you don't do. You don't get to choose to not pay a price. You get to choose which poison you're going to take. That's it. So if you're going to stand up for something, stand up for your truth. It'll shape you, because people will respond and object and tell you why you're a fool and a biased moron and why you're ignorant. And then if you listen to them, you'll be just that much less like that the next time you say something. And if you do that for 5 years, you'll be so damn tough and articulate and able to communicate and withstand pressure that you won't even recognize yourself. And then you'll be a force to contend with. It is not safe to speak, and it never will be. But the thing you got to keep in mind is that it's even less safe not to speak, right? It's a balance of risks. It's like you want to pay the price for being who you are and stating your mode of being in the world, or do you want to pay the price for being a bloody serf, one that's enslaved him or herself? Well, that's a major price, man. That thing unfolds over decades, and you'll just be a miserable worm at the end of about 20 years of that, right? No self-respect, no power, no ability to voice your opinions, nothing left but resentment because everyone's against you, because of course you've never stood up for yourself. It's like, say what you think carefully, pay attention to your words. The price is, it's a price you want to pay if you are willing to believe that truth is the cornerstone of society. And in the most real sense, if you're willing to take that leap, then tell the truth and see what happens. And nothing better could possibly happen to you. There'll be ups and downs, and there'll be pushback, and there'll be controversy and all of that, but it doesn't matter. The truth is what redeems the world from hell, and that's the truth. And we saw plenty of hell over the last 100 years, you know, and we haven't learned a bloody thing from it. It's like, wake up, tell the truth. Tell the truth, or at least don't lie, and that's a start. And you got to understand that's a risk.
I did a lot of counseling work with people who were, coaching work, I guess, with people who were fairly spectacularly successful, and they were usually workaholics. You know, they're the sort of people that were like, they'd work 80 hours a week, just nonstop. That's just what they were like. And one of the things we were always trying to figure out was, well, how much should you work? Because one answer is you just work till you die, right? I mean, you just exhaust yourself. And, well, that's not a good idea. And then you have to figure out why that isn't a good idea. It's got to be something like this, is that you don't want to do so much work that the amount of work you do interferes with the amount of work that you could still do, right? Because if you work like mad for 2 weeks and then you have to lie in a hospital bed for a month, that obviously isn't very productive. So you have to figure out how much you can work diligently and then how much you have to recuperate so that you can get back up and work again. And, you know, that's, people have basically settled on something like this and given it the divine imprimatur. That's one way of thinking about it, which is, well, you can toil away for 6 days and no wonder, because you have to work, but you should rest at least one day out of seven, because otherwise, well, you don't appreciate life. That might be part of it. And plus, I think it's more a matter of iterability, you know, because one of the things that defines morality is the capacity to repeat something, right? So if something is properly structured in a moral manner, then you can do it over and over and over again without any degeneration. And so that's kind of like a relationship. If your relationship is negotiated, you can continue to negotiate it, and then you can have a relationship that lasts for a long time. You can do it today and next week and next month and next year. You can maintain it across time. And this, I would say, is the wisdom that's been garnered over God only knows what period of time. That's a good thing for modern people to know, because we seem to be, even though, you know, we're very wealthy by historical standards, our capacity to relax isn't exactly what it could be, and I think that's really hard on people.
What Panksepp observed, and I think this is a brilliant piece of science, is that, first of all, juvenile male rats in particular like to rough and tumble play. They like to wrestle. And they actually pin each other, just like little kids do, or like adult wrestlers do. They pin their shoulders down, and that basically means you win. And so, okay, so that's pretty cool. But what's even cooler, I think, well, there's three things. One is, the rats will work for an opportunity to get into an arena where they know the play might occur. And so that's one of the scientific ways of testing an animal's motivation, right? So imagine you have a starving rat, and it knows that it's got food down the end of a corridor. You put a little spring on its tail and measure how hard it pulls, and that gives you an indication of its motivational force. Now, imagine the starving rat that's trying to get to some food, and you have a little spring on its tail, and you waft in some cat odor. So now that rat is starving and wants to get out of there. He's going to try to pull even farther towards the food. So getting away plus getting forward are separate motivational systems, and if you can add them together, it's real potent. And part of the reason why in the future authoring exercise that you guys are going to do as the class progresses, you're asked to outline the place you'd like to end up, which is your desired future, and also the place that you could end up if you let everything fall apart, is so that your anxiety chases you and your approach systems pull you forward. You're maximally motivated then. And it's important, because otherwise you can be afraid of pursuing the things that you want to pursue, right? And that's very common. And so then the fear inhibits you as the promise pulls you forward, but it makes you weak because you're afraid. You want to get your fear behind you, pushing you. And so what you want to be is afraid, more afraid of not pursuing your goals than you are of pursuing them. It's very, very helpful. And lots of times in life, and this is something really worth knowing, you know, and this is one of the advantages to being an autonomous adult, is you don't get to pick the best thing. You get to pick your poison. You have two bad choices, and you get to pick which one you're willing to suffer through. And every choice has a bit of that element in it. And so if you know that, it's really freeing, because otherwise you torture yourself by thinking, well, maybe there's a good solution to this, you know, compared to the bad solution. It's like, no, sometimes there's just risky solution one and risky solution two. And sometimes both of them are really bad, but you at least get to pick which one you're willing to suffer through. And that actually makes quite a bit of difference, because you're also facing it voluntarily then, instead of it chasing you. And that is an entirely different psychophysiological response. Challenge versus threat, it's not the same, even if the magnitude of the problem is the same. And so putting yourself in a challenging, let's call it mind frame, you can't just do that by magic. Putting yourself in a challenging mind frame is much easier on you psychophysiologically, because you don't go into the generalized stress response to the same degree. and you're activating your exploratory and seeking systems, which are dopaminergically mediated and that involve positive emotion. So if you can face something voluntarily rather than having it chase you, it's way better for you psychophysiologically. So that's partly why, well, it's worthwhile to go find the dragon in its lair instead of waiting for it to come and eat you. So, and especially when you also add the idea that if you go find the dragon in its lair, you might find it when it's a baby instead of a full-fledged bloody monster that is definitely going to take you down.
You know, having children, I suppose, too, this has been enhanced by my ill health in recent years, but I always feel that it's a privilege to spend time with my children. And I have some sense of how fast time goes. You know, I've always had a very acute sense of the finitude of existence. And so, and this is a good hint for people who have children, but with regards to your family members at all, is don't take it for granted. You know, every second you get that isn't painful, you should cherish.
One of the things you don't want is too much mismatch between you and that person on the five fundamental dimensions. So, for example, if you're really extroverted and you have a really introverted partner, you're going to engage in continual conflict about how much social activity the two of you should subject yourself to. And it's very, very difficult for people who broadly differ on those dimensions to come to consensus, because it's not just a matter of opinion, right? It's really a matter of different, if you're looking at extremes, of really different types of people. And the thing about introverts is they just don't enjoy large-scale social interaction that much. One-on-one, they're often fine, but in a group, they don't like that, and it tires them out. Whereas a real extrovert, it's like you isolate them, and they just wither on the vine, because a huge part of what actually motivates them in a positive way is tangled up with social interaction. And so if you're an agreeable person and you have a particularly disagreeable partner, you're also going to run into problems, because the agreeable person will say whatever you want whenever, and the disagreeable person will say, well, I'd like to know what the hell you want for a change, and be much more harsh and much more demanding in the situation. And the agreeable person is going to find the disagreeable person harsh and unpleasant, and the disagreeable person is going to find the agreeable person wishy-washy and unable to stand up for themselves. And again, that's actually one of the primary sources of tension between men and women, because women tend to be higher in agreeableness than men. It's about half a standard deviation, which is quite a large difference by psychological standards. And so what that means fundamentally, just so you have some sense of how large an effect that is that if you have a group of men and women and you pick out random pairs, the woman is going to be more agreeable than the man 60% of the time. So that's not an overwhelming proportion, but it's reliable, and it's quite large by psychological standards. So there's the problem with agreeableness. Some of you have had roommates, and maybe you're more orderly than your roommate. What does it mean? It means you're annoyed by mess before they are. And you don't have to be annoyed by mess much before your less orderly roommate for you to be the one that's always running around picking things up. And so actually, one of the things that's emerged from the psychometric analysis is that women are slightly more orderly than men. And I suspect that has something to do with the, inequitable distribution of housework. Because even if imagine that your proclivity is to be triggered by disorder 25 seconds before your partner's. Well, you're going to end up, it doesn't take much difference for you to be the one that's always concerned about the mess first. So anyways, and so if you're a really orderly person and you live with a disorderly person, well, good luck getting along with them. They're going to regard you as like uptight and over concerned with details and unwilling to relax, that's for sure. And they're going to regard you as, well, just a bloody mess. And how can anyone possibly live with someone like you? So another reason why it's useful to understand your personality is because I think it gives you a better crack at finding someone that you can actually live with over the long run. And we don't know what the optimal, I don't think you want to live with someone who's exactly like you, because then both of you have the same strengths and weaknesses. And there's a bit of a problem there, right? Because maybe an agreeable person can use a bit of a disagreeable person around them to balance each other out, and vice versa, right? So we don't understand the optimal balance for long-term thriving in a relationship, but I think we do understand the fact that if you're too different in your traits, where you're different is going to constitute a chronic source of conflict.
Here's the key to a good relationship. It's not the only one, but watch your person carefully, carefully, carefully. And whenever they do something that you would like them to do more of, tell them that that was really good and mean it. And it's not manipulative, because if it's manipulative, it won't work. It's like you have to say, wow, I'm so glad you did that. And you have to be precise. Here's what you just did that I thought was great. And oh boy, that's so nice that you noticed. I can't believe that you noticed. It's like, you know, you do that 20 times and the person will be like the rat that's just pushing the lever for cocaine, you know. So, but no, I'm serious. It's Skinner established this. B.F. Skinner noticed this a long time ago. Reward is intensely useful in terms of modifying behavior.
You can establish the ground rules explicitly and have a discussion about it. Are we going to lie to each other or not? Are we going to tell each other the truth to the degree that we can to make that an actual goal, and to talk through the consequences of doing that and not doing it? And then I would also say, whenever a hiccup occurs in the relationship, maybe you don't call it out at each hiccup, you know, because you have to have a certain amount of silent tolerance in any relationship to let small infractions go. But if they repeat, my rule is three times. And it's the rule that I share with my wife. If something happens three times that is causing emotional upset, anger, jealousy, disappointment, resentment, frustration, any of those things, anything that you don't want to experience and that you especially don't want to experience repeatedly, then you can call it out. And if you have three examples, your case is much better made than if you just have one. I would also say that when you call it out, you know, you could say, look, we were at a party the other night and I felt as if you were paying too much intense attention to Dave. Flirting going on there. That's what it looked like to me. There was some flirting going on there. And, you know, that made me uncomfortable. You don't say, well, you were flirting, stop doing it. You say, well, this is how it looked. This is what it looked like to me. And here was my response. And then you want to think, and maybe I'm a damn fool and blind and jealous and stupid, and I'm misinterpreting, or maybe it was a harmless flirtation of the sort that people will engage in because it adds a little bit of spice to a social interaction. You want to find out. It's really convenient if it's the other person's fault, except then you're laden with living with that person, so it really doesn't help you anyways. But it's convenient because then they have to change. But you've got to think about this over the long run. You're going to be interacting with this person on a minute-by-minute basis for decades. If you're the idiot and that's causing trouble, then you should find out. So you want to say, well, look, this is what I saw. What's your explanation of what's going on? And then they'll offer you their viewpoint and hopefully they'll do the same thing. They'll think, well, this is my intent. And maybe they have to go think about it, but this is my intent and this is what I saw. And I think you're being oversensitive in that situation. And you peel back the explanations layer by layer until you both agree on what happened. And more importantly, on what you're going to do about it in the future. And that's really hard. And you have to come to a negotiated agreement about that situation. And you have to pay attention to your own uncomfortable negative emotions in order to manage that and not pretend that everything's all right, or that you're nicer than you are, or that you're less jealous than you are, or less blind. Or I don't think competition between people who are in a monogamous relationship is useful, particularly. It's not zero-sum competition. I mean, you can compete in a game-like sense, not existential competition. You're on the same team. That's the point. You know, and if one of you is feeling left behind for one reason or another, it's time to throw that out on the table and say, look, I'm playing second fiddle here far too often. What can we do about that? Well, it looks like you need it. And like, I've got an adventure. It looks like you need one too. Well, how can we rearrange the situation so I have my adventure? And then it's up to that person too to figure out what obstacles they might be putting up in their own pathway, right? That's stopping them. And then they have, you know, they're angry at you for getting in the way, but it's actually a consequence of them using you as a convenient excuse for not doing something difficult. those things all have to be sorted through. It's very hard. These conversations are extremely difficult. It's no wonder people avoid them. I also think people are not taught to negotiate at all. That's a real shame. First of all, you figure out what you want. This is what I want. Then you tell the person, then you strategize with them so that you can get what you want and they can get what they want. And you both know what that is and away you go together. That usually comes out. It's usually obscured and hidden and comes out awkwardly and difficulty and with difficulty if it comes out at all. And people fool themselves into thinking that it's okay what they're doing. I'm sacrificing myself for the children and that's okay. I'm sacrificing myself for my husband's career and that's okay. I'm working at a job I can't stand because I need to support my wife and children, and that's okay. I mean, sometimes that is okay, but it has to be out, clear, in the open, talked about, negotiated, discussed. You know, I think you can be a slave or a tyrant, or you can negotiate. Those are your options. And we default to slavery and tyranny because that doesn't require any cognitive effort. And then we pretend that everything's all right. And then it blows up in our faces and we end up divorced.
Life is suffering. Right. Indisputable. What do you do about that? You voluntarily accept it and then strive to overcome the suffering that's a consequence of that. And you do that for you, and you do that in a way that makes it better for other people. And then that works. And one question might be, well, how well does it work? And the answer is, the only way that you can find out is by trying it. That's it. That's the existential element of it. The proof is to be derived by the incarnation of the attitude in your own life. No one can tell you how it will work for you. It's the thing that your destiny is to discover that. You have to make the decisions to begin with. It's like, because you can't do this without commitment. You have to commit to it first. That's the act of faith that Kierkegaard was so insistent upon. You have to say, I'm going to act as if being is good. I'm going to act as if truth is the pathway to enlightenment. I'm going to act as if I should pursue the deepest meaning possible in my life. And there's reasons to do none of those. They're real reasons. So it's really a decision. But you can't find out what the consequence of the decision is unless you make the decision. When you're 25, you can be an idiot. It's no problem. Even when you're out in a job search, it's like, well, you don't have any experience and you're kind of clueless. It's, yeah, you're young. You know, it's no problem. That's what young people are like, but they're full of potential. Okay, well, now you're the same person at 30. It's like people aren't so thrilled about you at that point. It's like, what the hell have you been doing for the last 10 years? Well, I'm just as clueless as I was when I was 22. It's, yeah, but you're not 22. You're an old infant, right? And that's an ugly thing, an old infant. So part of the reason you choose your damn sacrifice, because the sacrifice is inevitable, but at least you get to choose it. And then there's something that's even more complex than that in some sense, is that the problem with being a child is that all you are is potential, and it's really low resolution. You could be anything, but you're not anything. So then you go and you adopt an apprenticeship, roughly speaking, and then you become something. And when you're something, that makes the world open up to you again. You know, like if you're a really good plumber, then you end up being far more than a plumber, right? You end up being a good employer. You know, if you're a really good plumber, well, then you have some employees, you run a business, you train some other people, you enlarge their lives, you're kind of a pillar of the community, you have your family. Once you pass through that narrow training period, which narrows you and constricts you and develops you at the same time, then you can come out the other end with a bunch of new possibility at hand. And Jung talked about that. He thought that the proper path of development in the last half of life was to rediscover the child that you left behind as you were apprenticing. And so then you get to be something and regain that potential at the same time. If you go in the woods and you find a bear, especially a grizzly, well, you're in real trouble if it's a grizzly. But if it's a black bear, you know, generally speaking, if you stand your ground and make a hell of a lot of noise, that thing will leave you alone. But if you run, well, what's it supposed to think? It eats things that run from it. So that's exactly where that idea came from. You turn tail and run, and then the thing that you're afraid of is really a monster, and it's going to, like, get you and eat you. It's like, well, that's true psychologically as well. So I have a client. She's afraid of elevators. The elevator door opens. She goes, that's a tomb. And I thought, oh, wow, I thought it was an elevator. But for you, it's not a bloody elevator. It's death. And so that's what you're afraid of. It's worse than that. You're afraid of being trapped inside there in the dark, alone, not knowing if anyone is going to rescue you, stuck there with your damn imagination, freaking out. it's like. And if that's not, and then maybe you have a heart attack because you're so terrified and you die. So then you say, okay, well, you're afraid of the damn elevator, but it's not an elevator, it's a tomb. And the tomb is partly you and partly, it's partly the elevator and partly your unconscious mind. And so, well, what can you handle? Can you go and look at an elevator from 10 feet away? It's like, yes. Okay. How about 9 feet away? Yes. 5 feet? Yes. 4 feet? No. Okay. No problem. 4.5 feet. We're going to go from that elevator. We're going to look at the damn thing until you're bored of it. Because that's what we're trying to... You should be bored of the elevator. Because then you're not afraid of it, obviously. It's like, it's an elevator. So, this week they're 4.5 feet from the elevator. Next week they're 1 foot from the elevator. And the week after that, the horrible gates of hell open and they look inside and they don't run. And so, hey, they're tougher than they thought they were. And that's what you're teaching them, actually. You're not teaching them that the world isn't dangerous. Because that's a stupid thing to teach someone. Bloody right, the world is dangerous. It's terrifying. And sometimes people they realize that. And the veil lifts. And they see horror everywhere. They see that. And then they think, well, I'm just a little rabbit. I'm over here in the corner. I can't move. I'm petrified. And then they can't move. They hide at home. They cower at home. Because everything has become a predatory domain. And so what you teach them is, you're not as much of a rabbit as you think.
So what you do first, if you're going to teach someone not to be afraid of a mouse, is teach them how not to be afraid. So you put them in a chair and you do a relaxation exercise with them. And then you show them a picture of a mouse. And you say, just breathe, you know, calm down. And so they calm down. And then sooner or later, they can look at the pictures of mice by themselves. And then maybe you could throw a like stuffed mouse at them. And then maybe, you know, they could walk by a pet store and look at a mouse and so on and so forth until you get them like holding rats. And so, you know, that works. But it works even if you don't relax them. In fact, it works just as well. So the old behavioral idea that it was counter-conditioning was wrong, just like the idea that the reason you were afraid of a rat was because of conditioning. It's like, of course you're afraid of a rat. It's a rat. You know, it's just like you're afraid of snakes. You know, to a lesser or greater degree. And people actually become more afraid of snakes as they get older, interestingly enough, which is not what you'd really expect, right? Unless it was a biological function. So anyways, all you have to do is show people the thing they're afraid of. What do they learn? They don't learn that the thing isn't frightening. They learn that they're tough.
We're built for struggle, us human beings. You're not after the bubbles of bliss that Dostoevsky described in Notes from Underground. We're built to contend with the world. We're built to contend with reality. You want a challenge. And the best way that you can take on a challenge, because a challenge fortifies you. So you don't want to be secure, you want to be strong. And you get strong by taking on optimal challenges. And so you lay out your destiny in the world and you take the slings and arrows of fate. And you make yourself stronger while you're doing so. And you might fail and fortune might do you in. But it's your best bet. And you know, people have extracted unbelievable successes out of catastrophic failures. And I'm not saying that in a naive way. I know perfectly well what happens to people. You know, you're doing fine in life and then you get cancer. And then 6 months later, you're dead. And all the heroism in the world isn't going to save you at that point. But that's not the point. That's not the point. Life is bounded by mortality. But that doesn't mean that you don't get out there and contend. And you develop by contending and you minimize the net amount of suffering in the world. And that's something, man. That's something to do.
I'll tell you a little story. This is in my book. So I had this landlord in Montreal. He lived next door to me. He was an ex-Hells Angels biker. He'd spent a lot of time in prison. And his wife had borderline personality disorder, and she committed suicide when I lived there. My wife and I went over there, and we had spaghetti dinner one night, and we sort of communicated. And I bought a poster from him because he made these wooden posters that had neon on them, and that's how he made a living. He'd kind of trained himself to be a bit of an electronics guy, and so he made these things, and he was trying to quit drinking, and we talked about that. He was a lot older than me. He was like 20 years older than me. I was about 25 at this point. And we got along pretty well. But every now and then, he'd go out and get and drink. And he could really drink, you know, like he was one of these guys who could drink like 60 beer. And you think, well, no one can drink that much. And you're wrong. I studied alcohol for like 10 years. Some of my subjects' fathers drank 40 ounces of vodka a day and had been doing it for 20 years. So you can drink a lot, and he could drink a lot. And what would happen? He was trying to not drink, but he'd go out and go on a binge, and then he'd be gone for like 3 days. And he'd drink up all his money, and then we'd hear him out in the backyard howling at the moon with this little ugly dog he had, you know? And he'd howl, and the dog would howl, and he'd howl, and the dog would howl. And
And it was rather unsettling and made my wife nervous. But worse, you know, now and then he'd come to the door at like 3 a.m, eh? And he'd knock on the door and he'd be standing there and he'd ask me if I would like to buy his toaster or his microwave because he needed some money to keep drinking. And, you know, I didn't really want to buy his toaster or his microwave, but when the ex-Hells Angel, Joual-speaking, 60-beer-drunk Quebecois biker shows up at your door at 3 a.m, and offers to sell you his microwave, the easiest thing is to say, I really need a microwave. So, you know, I bought the microwave and the toaster and some other things. So one time he took me out on his 750 Honda, and he put me on the back of it. He wanted to show me his lair, I guess, his hangouts. And I got his wife's helmet on, but it didn't fit. It just sit on the top of my head. And he said, I got on the bike and he said, if the cops chase us, we're not stopping. and then away we went. And we went to these bars downtown on Saint Laurent. They were very rough places. And he got into like 4 fights that night because he was a rough guy, you know, and these kind of punk guys would come up to him and sort of challenge him and act stupidly around him. And he was very skeptical. And if you were acting stupidly around him for any length of time, he'd just hit you because he felt that that's what you deserved. And perhaps he was right, you know. So I had a firsthand opportunity to observe him. So anyways, he, sure enough, about a week or two after we had this conversation, he showed up at the door, knock, 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 you know, I opened the door and he was standing there, you know, with his eyes kind of half closed and he was swaying. And he had, I don't remember what the appliance was this time, but he wanted to sell it to me. And I said, I'm not, Paul, I can't buy this. I'm not going to buy this because I know you're trying to quit drinking. And if I give you this money, then you're going to go and drink it up. And it's not going to be good for you. And what else did I tell him? I think I told him as well that this whole thing of him coming to my house at like 2 a.m. was scaring my wife, who he liked, and that it had to stop. And believe me, man, I was thinking about what I was saying. Because he was watching me like a rough guy watches you. And a rough guy watches you like this. He thinks, if you say one thing that indicates contempt, you're going to bloody well pay for it. And so I was finding my words like, you know, I was crossing a swamp and trying to look for the rocks underneath the surface. And I said what I had to say very, very carefully. And he looked at me for about 15 seconds. And that's a long time to be looked at 3 a.m. And he left. And he never came back to sell me anything again. And we got along fine. But that's a good illustration of this issue with regards to truth and success in the strange land. Because I was in the strange land when I was talking to my neighbor, my landlord. Then, and I managed to say what was true carefully enough, so despite the fact that he was a very violent person and that he was a very intoxicated person and that he had every reason to be suspicious of me and we couldn't communicate very well and I didn't do what he wanted, that he took it and he left and there was no problem and life went on just fine after that. And so we don't want to underestimate the utility of establishing this bounded relationship with the ideal and attempting to live with some nobility in truth while aiming at the highest ideal. There's nothing about that that's anything but strengthening and positive. And it's exactly what you need to set against the catastrophe and uncertainty of life.
Treat yourself like you're someone responsible for helping. You're someone that you are responsible for helping. So what that means is you have to start from the presupposition that despite all your flaws and insufficiencies, that it's worth having you around and that it would be okay if things were better for you. So you need to take care of yourself like you're taking care of someone you care for. So there's a bit of a detachment in that. And then the next thing is, okay, so now look 3 to 5 years down the road. Okay, you get to have what you need and want, assuming you're being reasonable and that you actually want it, which means you're willing to make the sacrifices that would make it possible. Well, you need a pathway to it. You know, if it's 10 stories up above you, you need a staircase to get there, right? And so you have to build the staircase too. And so in the future authoring program. So you're asked, first of all, okay, here's, you get to have what you want and need. That's the proposition. But you have to aim at it. You have to define it and aim at it. So here, so then the first thing is, okay, if you could put your family together the way you wanted it to be, what mm-hmm. would that look like? And mm-hmm. so that might be your siblings and your parents, but that also might be, you know, your wife or your husband and your kids, assuming that you're at that point in your life. If you could have the family you wanted, what would that look like? Right, okay. Career, same thing. You get to have the career or the job that is within your grasp, necessary, and suitable for you if you were taking care of yourself. How are you going to educate yourself? Because you're not as smart as you should be. There's a lot more things you need to know. So you got to keep learning and moving mm-hmm. forward. So you need to plan for that. How are you going to take care of yourself mentally and physically? Right? So how are you going to avoid that the catastrophic temptations, for example, of drugs and alcohol? Because that pulls a lot of people down. You need a plan for that. You're going to be a social drinker? How much are you going to drink? How much is too much? What about your drug use? Mm. You got to regulate that so it isn't a pitfall. How are you going to use your time meaningful and productively outside of work? Because you need a plan for that. So you have, do you want a long-term, stable, intimate relationship? And if you do, then how would you like that to lay itself out? You got to have a vision for that, because if you don't have a vision, you're not going to aim at it. Absolutely. And if you don't aim at it, then you won't even see the opportunities when they arise. That's the thing that's so cool. I wrote about this in chapter 10, which is Be Precise in Your Speech. It's a chapter about the fact that aims structure your perceptions. So, for example, once you aim at something, your brain, literally, the perceptual structures in your brain, in your visual cortex, reorient themselves to calculate a pathway to the aim. And then what they show you in the world is obstacles to that path and mm-hmm. and open pathways to the path. That's actually how the world reveals itself. Just like when you're driving in a car and you have a map and you aim at a particular place, then all the things that right. are related to that place show up in the world. It's exactly the same thing, because you are traveling through time and space, right? And you need a map. And so after you answer these seven questions, and you're encouraged to do it badly, because a bad plan is better than no plan. It gives you something to improve. Mm-hmm. So even if your aim is vague, and even if it's off target, if you start aiming and you see you're off target, then you can shift and you can make it more precise.
You know, if you take people, and I've told you this, and you expose them voluntarily to things that they are avoiding and are afraid of.
You take young people, say they're 16 to 22, and they're not really feeling that good about who they are, because their life is chaotic and in disorder, and they don't know where they're going. And
that they know they need to overcome in order to meet their goals, their self-defined goals. If you can teach people to stand up in the face of the things they're afraid of, they get stronger. And you don't know what the upper limits to that are, because you might ask yourself, like, if for 10 years, if you didn't avoid doing what you knew you needed to do, by your own definitions, right, within the value structure that you've created to the degree that you've done that, what would you be like? Well, you know, there are remarkable people who come into the world from time to time, and there are people who do find out over decades-long periods what they could be like if they were who they were, if they spoke their being forward. And they get stronger and stronger and stronger, and we don't know the limits to that. We do not know the limits to that. And so you could say, well, in part, perhaps the reason that you're suffering unbearably can be left at your feet, because you're not everything you could be, and you know it. And of course, that's a terrible thing to admit, and it's a terrible thing to consider, but there's real promise in it, right? Because it means that perhaps there's another way that you could look at the world, and another way that you could act in the world, so what it would reflect back to you would be much better than what it reflects back to you now. I often ask undergraduates how many hours a day you waste, or how many hours a week you waste, and the classic answer is something like 4 to 6 hours a day. You know, inefficient studying, watching things on YouTube that not only do you not want to watch, that you don't even care about, that make you feel horrible about watching after you're done, that's probably 4 hours right there. You know, you think, well, that's 20, 25 hours a week, it's 100 hours a month, that's 2.5 full work weeks, it's half a year of work weeks per year. And if your time is worth $20 an hour, which is a radical underestimate, it's probably more like 50 if you think about it in terms of deferred wages. If you're wasting 20 hours a week, you're wasting $50,000 a year. And you are doing that right now. And it's because you're young, wasting $50,000 a year is a way bigger catastrophe than it would be for me to waste it, because I'm not going to last nearly as long. And so if your life isn't everything it could be, you could ask yourself, well, what would happen if you just stopped wasting the opportunities that are in front of you? You'd be who knows how much more efficient, 10 times more efficient, 20 times more efficient. That's the Pareto distribution. You have no idea how efficient people get. It's completely, it's off the charts. Well, and if we all got our act together collectively and stopped making things worse, because that's another thing people do all the time, not only do they not do what they should to make things better, they actively attempt to make things worse because they're spiteful or resentful or arrogant or deceitful or homicidal or genocidal or all of those things all bundled together in an absolutely pathological package. If people stopped really, really trying just to make things worse, we have no idea how much better they would get just because of that.
One of the things psychologists have done for the last 20 years, especially the social psychologists, is push this idea of self-esteem. You should feel good about yourself. And I think, why would you tell someone 20 that? It's like, you should feel good about who you are. It's like, no, you shouldn't. Why should you feel good about who you are? It's like, you should feel good about who you could be. I'm not saying that people shouldn't have confidence, but like often you take young people, say they're 16 to 22, and they're not really feeling that good about who they are because their life is chaotic and in disorder and they don't know where they're going and they don't know which way is up. But the thing is, it has to be stated with precision. It's like yeah. You should treat yourself as if you're valuable, especially in yes. potential, but you should concentrate on who you should become, especially if you're young. And so let's say you're miserable and nihilistic and chaotic and depressed and all of that now, and you have your reasons, you know, terrible parenting, abuse, all of those things. It's like, well, you should feel good about yourself. It's like, no, it's not the right message. Is that it's more like you should understand how much potential there is within you to set that straight. And then you should do everything you can to manifest that in the world, and it will set it straight. And that's better than self-esteem. It's like, You're in a crooked, horrible position. Okay, fine. There's a lot of suffering and pain associated with that. Yeah, you can't just feel good about that because it's not good. But you can do something about it. You can genuinely do something about it. And I think all the evidence suggests that that's the case. So I'm telling young people, look, there's no matter how bad your situation is, I'm not going to pretend it's okay. It's not okay. It's tragic, tainted with malevolence. And some people really get hurt by malevolent people, like, you know, terribly hurt. Sometimes they never recover. It's really awful. But there's more to you than you think. And if you stand up and face it with a positive, with a noble vision, with discipline and intent, you can go far farther to overcoming it than you can imagine. And that's the principle upon which you should predicate your behavior. And I think that one of the things that's really nice about being a clinical psychologist is that this isn't just guesswork. Like one of the things, we know two things in clinical psychology. One is truthful conversations redeem people. Because if you come to a clinical psychologist whose worth is salt, you have a truthful conversation. The conversation is, well, here's what's wrong with my life. And here's what caused it. You know, maybe it takes a year to have that conversation. And both of the participants are doing everything they can to lay it out properly. Here's how it might be fixed. Here's what a beneficial future might look like. And so it's a completely honest conversation if it's working well. And all that's happening in the conversation is that the two people involved are trying to make things better. That's the goal. Let's see if we can have a conversation that will make things better. Okay, so we know that works. It does make things better. And then another thing we know is that, well, let's say there's a bunch of things that you're afraid of that are in your way. So you have some vision about who you want to be. Maybe you have to, you know, you want to be successful in your career. So you have to learn to talk in front of a group. It's like, okay, well, you're afraid of that. It's like, no wonder you don't want to be humiliated. So, okay, so what do we do about that? Well, maybe we first get you to speak in front of one person and then three people, you know, for 5 minutes and then for 10 minutes, like graduated exposure to what you're afraid of. Voluntary graduated exposure to what you're afraid of is curative. And that's true. It works. The documentation is in. It's how people learn. So to tell people that if you confront the world forthrightly, if you speak the truth, and you expose yourself courageously to those things that you're afraid of, that your life will improve, and so will the life of people around you. Like, as far as I'm concerned, that's as close to undeniable fact as we've got. And it also dovetails nicely with the underlying archetypal stories, the heroic stories. It's like, go out there, find the dragon, confront it,
It's a dragon. It might eat you. It's dangerous. But it's worse to cower at home and wait for it to come and devour you. Go out there. Confront it. Get the gold. Share it with the community. It's like, yeah, it's the oldest story of mankind. What could you do to improve yourself? Well, let's step one step backwards. The first question might be, why should you even bother improving yourself? And I think the answer to that is something like, so you don't suffer any more stupidly than you have to. And maybe so others don't have to either. It's something like that. You know, like there's a real injunction at the bottom of it. It's not some casual self-help doctrine. It's that if you don't organize yourself properly, you'll pay for it, and in a big way, and so will the people around you. Now, and you could say, well, I don't care about that, but that's actually not true. You actually do care about that, because if you're in pain, you will care about it. And so you do care about it, even if it's just that negative way, you know. It's very rare that you can find someone who's in excruciating pain who would ever say, well, it would be no better if I was out of this. It's sort of pain is one of those things that brings the idea that it would be better if it didn't exist along with it. It's incontrovertible. So you get your act together so that there isn't any more stupid pain around you than necessary. Well, so then the question might be, well, how would you go about getting your act together? And the answer to that, and this is a phenomenological idea too, it's something like, look around for something that bothers you and see if you can fix it. So now you think, well, let's say you go into a, you can do this in a room. It's quite fun to do it just when you're sitting in a room, like a room, maybe your bedroom. You can sit there and just sort of meditate on it and think, okay, if I wanted to spend 10 minutes making this room better, what would I have to do? And you have to ask yourself that, right? It's not a command. It's like a genuine question. And things will pop out in the room that, you know, you like there's a stack of papers over there that's kind of bugging you, and you know that maybe little order there would be a good thing. And, you know, you haven't, there's some rubbish behind your computer monitor that you haven't attended to for like 6 months, and the room would be slightly better if it was a little less dusty and the cables weren't all tangled up the same way. And like if you allow yourself just to consider the expanse in which you exist at that moment, there'll be all sorts of things that'll pop out in it that you could just fix. And, you know, I might say, well, if you were coming to see me for psychotherapy, the easiest thing for us to do first would just be to get you to organize your room. You think, well, is that psychotherapy? And the answer is, well, it depends on how you conceive the limits of your being. And I would say, start where you can start. You know, if something announces itself to you, which is a strange way of thinking about it, as in need of repair, that you could repair, then, hey, fix it. You fix 100 things like that, your life will be a lot different. Now, I often tell people, too, fix the things you repeat every day, because people tend to think of those as trivial, right? You get up, you brush your teeth, you have your breakfast, you know, you have your routines that you go through every day. Well, those probably constitute 50% of your life. And people think, well, they're mundane, I don't need to pay attention to them. It's like, no, that's exactly wrong. The things you do every day, those are the most important things you do. Hands down. All you have to do is do the arithmetic. You figure it out right away. So 100 adjustments to your broader domain of being, and there's a lot less rubbish around and a lot fewer traps for you to step into. And so that's in keeping with Jung's idea about erasing the once you've got your mind and your emotions together, and once you're acting that out, then you can extend what you're willing to consider yourself and start fixing up the things that are part of your broader extent. Now, sometimes you don't know how to do that. So you might say, imagine you're walking down Bloor Street and there's this guy who's like alcoholic and schizophrenic and has been on the streets for 10 years. He sort of stumbles towards you and, you know, incoherently mutters something. That's a problem. And it would be good if you could fix it, but you haven't got a clue about how to fix that. You just walk around that and go find something that you could fix, because if you muck about in that, not only is it unlikely that you'll help that person, it's very likely that you'll get hurt yourself. So, you know, just because while you're experiencing things announce themselves as in need of repair doesn't mean that it's you right then and there that should repair them. You have to have some humility. You know, you don't walk up to a helicopter that isn't working and just start tinkering away with it. You have to stay within your domain of competence. But most of the time, if people look at their lives, you know, It's a very interesting thing to do. I like the idea of the room, because you can do that at the drop of a hat. You know, you go back to where you live and sit down and think, okay, I'm going to make this place better for half an hour. What should I do? And you have to ask, and things will just pop up like mad. And it's partly because your mind is a very strange thing. As soon as you give it a name, a genuine aim, it'll reconfigure the world in keeping with that aim. That's actually how you see to begin with. And so if you set it a task, especially, you have to be genuine about it, which is why you have to bring your thoughts and emotions together, and then you have to get them in your body so you're acting consistently. You have to be genuine about the aim, but once you aim, the world will reconfigure itself around that aim, which is very strange. And it's technically true. You know, the best example of that, you have all seen this video where you watch the basketballs being tossed back and forth between members of the white team versus the black team. And while you're doing that, a gorilla walks up into the middle of the video and you don't see it. It's like, you know, if you thought about that experiment for about 5 years, that would be about the right amount of time to spend thinking about it. Because what it shows you is that you see what you aim at. And that man, if you can get one thing through your head in, as a consequence of even being in university, that would be a good one. You see what you aim at. And so because one inference you might draw from that is, be careful what you aim at, right? It, what you aim at determines the way the world manifests itself to you. And so if the world is manifesting itself in a very negative way, one thing to ask is, are you aiming at the right thing?
I read the story. It was not a biography, if I remember correctly, of the captain. I might be wrong about that, but I've got the basic story right. Well, they had a shipwreck in the Antarctica. And then they were there for a whole year in the Antarctica, you know? And none of them died, not one. He didn't lose a single man, not one. He kept the morale high. And then they took this boat that was on the ship, and they crossed like 400 miles of the roughest ocean, the roughest frigid ocean in the world, right? You don't go in that ocean. And then they went to an island, and they walked across the island, across these mountains that no one else has ever climbed since. And they went to the city on the other side of the island, and they got a boat, and they went and rescued their compatriots, and everyone survived. It's like, Endurance is the name of the book. You read that book, man, you think, wow, people are really tough, you know, and it's ridiculous, so who knows how tough you are? And maybe you find out by going out to find out how tough you are, right? So you take on a challenge, one that you think you can master, that's just a bit beyond your grasp. And you master it, and then you're a little tougher, and you think, hey, that worked out pretty well. And so then you're more of a monster. And then you go out and you find another challenge that's even bigger, and you think, well, maybe I can do that too. And all of a sudden you can, and you get a little bit bigger, and God only knows what the limit is of you. And you find out by pushing yourself against the world.
Well, let's talk about friendships for a minute. Here's how you know if someone's your friend. A, you can tell them bad news. And they'll listen. They won't tell you why, you know, you're stupid and why that bad thing happened to you and how something worse happened to them once and, you know, derail the whole conversation. You can actually tell them bad news and they'll listen. So that's a good thing. And then this is a weirder thing. You can tell them good news and they'll help you celebrate. And that's a really good way of deciding who you should have around you. Because if you have someone around you, you know, something good happens to you, and you're kind of afraid to even admit it because, you know, God, something good happened to you. It's like, you let that be known and it'll certainly be taken away. So, you know, you come out and you sort of tell someone half-heartedly that something good happened to you. They give you a whack and then talk about, you know, the great thing that happened to them 3 years ago. Or worse, the great thing that happened to someone that they knew 3 years ago. You know, it's like, go away from that person. They're not helpful to you. And they're not helpful to themselves either. And so you want to surround yourself. You got to think about this. You got to surround yourself with people who want the best for the best part of you. You can hang around with weasels and losers that are trying to pull you down to justify the fact that they're spiraling downhill as well. And you know, the upside of that is you don't have to have any responsibility and you can all whine about how wretched life is, you know, so that's pretty attractive. But I would say it's also a bad medium to long-term plan. And so it's acceptable and desirable to try to surround yourself with people who are facilitating your development. You know, and you might say, well, I've got people around, I know them well, you know,
they're not doing that well, and they don't fit into that category. It's like, what's your point? What are you going to do with them exactly? If they'll listen and cooperate with you and move towards a better future, great. If they don't pay any attention and they keep doing the same damn things over and over and they're not going anywhere and it's painful, then maybe the proper thing to do is say, you just have your misery. I'll go off and have my life. And maybe you'll wake up at some point in the future and think that's a better way of being. Because just putting up with it is, they call that enabling, right? You put up with that sort of behavior, you're providing tacit consent for it and even tacit approval. It's like, it's a bad idea. You have, I would say, both the right and the responsibility to surround yourself with people who are good for the best part of you.
When I talk to people about doing the future authoring program, they often put it off. And it's not surprising because it's hard. But it's more than that. They think, well, I don't know how to write. I'm going to do a bad job. I don't really like assignments. I'm going to have to do it perfectly. I need to wait till I have enough time. And like one of those is enough to stop you cold, and all five of them, you're just done. And so I tell people, do it haphazardly, a tiny bit at a time, and badly, because you can do that. I tell my students when they're doing their thesis, master's thesis, write a really bad first draft. And then we have a little conversation about that, because they don't think I mean that. Because it sounds like a cliche in some sense. It's not a cliche. It's not a cliche at all. It means you're a terrible writer. But if someone put a gun to your head and said, you have to have your 100-page thesis done by next Monday, or I'll shoot you, but I don't care how terrible it is, you would sit down and write it. And the thing is, then you have it, right? Then you have something, and then you can fix it. You can iterate and fix it. That bad first draft, that's the most valuable thing, and so that's what you need. You need a bad first draft of yourself. And there's an idea that Jung developed about the trickster and the jester, the comedian, right? That the trickster is the precursor to the savior. That's one of the things I learned from Jung that was just, it's so unlikely. You'd never think that. It's so amazing that that might be the case, but the satirical and the ironic and the troublemaker, the comedian, the fool is the precursor to the savior. Why? Because you're a fool when you start something new. And so if you're not willing to be a fool, then you'll never start anything new. And if you never start anything new, then you won't develop. And so the willingness to be a fool is the precursor to transformation. And that's the same as humility. And so if you're going to write your destiny, you can do a bad first job. You're going to get smarter as you move forward. That's the thing, is that so something beckons to you. That's what happens here. Maybe the star that Geppetto wished on was the wrong damn star, but at least it was a star, right? At least it was in the sky. At least it moved him forward. And so you say in your life, well, something grips you and fills you with interest. And you think, well, should I do that? And the answer is, if not that, then something. What if it's a mistake? It's a mistake. Rest assured. What do you know? You're going to stumble around, right? And what's going to happen is this. You're going to move. You're going to not stay in stasis. You're not going to wander around in circles. And I see people like that. They said, well, I never knew what to do, and now I'm 40. It's like, that's not so good. That's not so good. And you might say, well, and there is a literature, too, that suggests that people are a lot more unhappy when they look back on their lives about the things they didn't do than they are about the mistakes they made while they were doing things. And so that's really worth thinking about, too, because there's redemptive mistakes. And a redemptive mistake would be a mistake that you make when you go out and try to do something. You know, you think, okay, I'm going to try to do this. And you're not good at it. You make a bunch of mistakes. It's like, what's the consequence if you pay attention? Is you're not quite so stupid anymore. That's the thing, is you've been informed by the results of your errors. And so what happens is you follow the beacon, you follow the light. And you're blind, so you don't know where the light is. It's dimly apprehended only, and you're afraid to follow it. But you decide to take some stumbling steps towards it. And as you take stumbling steps towards it, you become illuminated and enlightened and informed because of the nature of your experience, because you're pushing yourself beyond where you are, and you're going into the country that you have not yet been in. And you learn something. And so what happens then is the star moves. You move 10 feet towards it and you think, no, that's not right. I didn't get it right. It isn't there. It's actually there. And so then you see it somewhere else and you shift yourself slightly and you move forward. And that's what happens, is that you continue as you change. The thing that guides you forward moves, right? It's like God in the desert in Egypt, the pillar of light that you're following. It's moving. It's not a permanent thing. You move towards it, it moves away. It guides you forward. And so you say, well, is what I'm aiming at paradise itself? And the answer to that is no, because what do you know? You couldn't see paradise if it was right in front of you, but you might get a glimmer of it. And so you move towards it and you grow. And then the next time you open your eyes, you see a little bit more clearly. And that's what happens, is that just happens over and over, right? It keeps moving. And so you move like this. But the thing that's so cool is that all those zigs and zags, you say, and each of those zags is a catastrophe. I hit a wall, my God, and then I had to die a little bit, and I barely got back up. It's a phoenix transformation at each turn, and it's painful. But the thing is that even though you've traveled 20 miles, let's say, on that road, and you've only moved 3 miles forward, you've moved 3 miles forward instead of falling backwards, because that's the thing too, is that if you stand still, you fall backwards. You cannot stand still, because the world moves away from you if you stand still, and there's no stasis, there's only backwards. And so if you're not moving back forwards, then you're moving backwards. And that's more of the underlying truth of the Matthew principle. To those who have everything, more will be given. From those who have nothing, everything will be taken. It's a warning. Do not stay in one place. Well, as you zig and zag, maybe the cataclysm of each transformation starts to lessen. There's not so much of you that has to die with every mistake. And maybe you end up oriented at least reasonably properly. And if you were sensible, that would have been your trip. But it wasn't, right? It's that. And perhaps it's a lot worse than that. Perhaps there's no shortage of backtracking. But it doesn't matter, because as you stumble forward, you illuminate and inform yourself. And perhaps that's partly because the world is made of information. And if you encounter it and tangle with it, then it informs you, and then you become informed, and then you're in formation, and then you're ready.
Looking for a smarter choice for dental implants? Meet the Contact Dental Implant System from Biotech Dental. Trusted by clinicians across Europe and now available in the US. With a single prosthetic connection, streamlined surgical kits, and seamless digital workflows, Contact makes every step easier. It's clinically proven, intuitively designed, and surprisingly affordable. See for yourself why more dentists are switching to Biotech Dental's Contact System. Visit biotechdentalusa.com today to learn more. That's biotechdentalusa.com.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the comfort and support with a new mattress from Serta. Find the perfect mattress for a deep and restorative night's sleep. Take control of your sleep and save big money on Serta mattresses now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save.